Good afternoon. First, welcome to Bare Matter. Just curious question, how many of you have been here before? So about 2/3, so I can say this is a success for Bare Matter. And thank you for coming, and I thought both Joseph Emerson was here, I'm Raymond Laflamme. One of the ideas, or one of the Machiavellic plans that we've had for this special course is to bring the students and to get the university more involved with what's happening at Bare Matter. And this is one of the plans, is to have some of these actors here. And so in some sense, think of yourself as guinea pigs in that experiment of bringing you. And at the same time, we'll make you walk a mile or two, fresh air, and kind of put you in good shape to go. So, as I said, this is an experiment as a course. I don't think there's ever been a course like this in the foundation of quantum mechanics where you learn about some of the foundations of material to start with, and some lecture to come. After, we will talk about different viewpoints. But you should really think about this course in a much bigger and broader mind frame. The one in which we try to understand the world around us. How do we comprehend what's going on around us? Think about yourself as being in a court case, part of a jury. You have people who come and tell you about certain facts of some things which might or not have happened. And from this, you're supposed to conclude at the end if somebody is guilty or not guilty, or try to make a story about what has happened and decide if things are right or not. In some sense, I've never been in a jury, but as a scientist, I would always worry to go to a jury because I would never be 100% sure that I get the right story or not. And this is very appropriate for this particular lecture, because quantum mechanics was invented 100 years ago and people are trying to understand it and comprehend it. And there's no clear one way to put all the facts which comes from experiments together and make a picture of all of this, which is easy to understand with the concepts that we've learned since we've been born. And so the goal of this, all of this, is to really make yourself think about there will be a set of facts that Joseph will introduce, and these facts will be talked about with different lecturers, and they will talk to you about how they interpret these facts and try to make a picture of what the world around us is, which is this interpretation of quantum mechanics. And the fact that there are 4 or 5 lecturers which will come from and talk about different viewpoints tell you that there's not one truth or false way of today of thinking about this. So this is what we're going to go and try to do with you, is to try to show you how to do this. And then hopefully, if this would be a real success, this course, is if in 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, you have a situation in your life where you have a series of facts, and you say, oh, if we analyze it this way or this way or this way, do we have the tools to kind of understand what's happening and make some prediction and try to get it right? So this is the big picture of this talk, to really try to make a sort of picture, an understanding of series of facts together. All of this will be focused to quantum mechanics. But think about quantum mechanics in some sense from that viewpoint as an example where in science today, we're not able to kind of pick up one part of the way of making sense of it. And these different viewpoints come in fact, bump into each other in different ways and seems to contradict in some way our gut feeling of how things should go. And this is the fun part about this interpretation of quantum mechanics. Of course, there's no truth, there's no false thing. Well, there'll be some truth to start with, there'll be some mathematical equation. So if you agree with the beginning, you should agree with the end. There are things which might be false, and it will be your job to take them up. Which leads to part of your job is really to keep the person who's in front straight and make sure that you understand what he's saying. So we want to have some feedback and some interaction from the audience. And with this, I'll leave Joseph to talk a little bit more into details about how the course is structured, about how the different things are going to come together, how the evaluation is going to go, and see how things. If you have questions, comments, don't be shy. It's one of those course that.
Okay, question. Quantum mechanics is one of the two pillars of quantum physics, right? The other one is general theory. So would it be fair to say that we understand general relativity?
I think we have a much, much better understanding of general relativity than of quantum mechanics. And the reason is that the concept of how we picture the world around us with general relativity is not the fundamental, the concept of how we picture reality is very, very similar to classical relativity. Some concepts are slightly different, but they are not as much as quantum mechanics. Like, an example of the difference of quantum mechanics compared to classical mechanics is something we are starting to think about having particles who are at two places at the same time. This doesn't seem to make sense classically with our classical mechanics viewpoint of the world. But there are experiments where, if you interpret it in a certain way, this is what you seem to conclude. So the understanding of quantum mechanics seems to be very different than the one from general relativity. The interesting thing, if you look at history, is that general relativity came from one person, Einstein. He essentially did all the fundamental work on it, produced a theory. Quantum mechanics came from a variety of different people, all putting in kind of building blocks together to sort of the theory of quantum mechanics. And I don't know if it's because it came from a lot of different people, or because intrinsically it's more complex, which I believe the latter. It's more complex because it's really changing what we understand and what we mean by reality. So, to come back and sum up your question, or the answer to this question, general relativity seems to be a lot more easy to understand than quantum mechanics. In fact, I don't think I've heard of a talk on interpretation of general relativity, for example. Although there are places where we're asking, does that really make sense in general relativity, singularities inside black holes, but not as much as quantum mechanics, where we see some of its effect all around us. Lasers, for example. And this is the goal of this lecture, to bring these different points, and we need to ask this question to articulate. And I hope by the end of this term, you will see some of the difference, although we won't talk about general relativity at all. But you can understand why are people so much fun at ease with quantum mechanics. So that's your turn.
Sounds so good on recording. So we're actually recording the lectures. There's a video camera at the top of the room, and the lectures will be available online, so anybody can view them whenever they want. And it'll be available to a wider audience as well. So I wanted to start out with this quote by Murray Gell-Mann, Nobel laureate, who knows what he's talking about when he talks about quantum mechanics. And the quote reads, "Quantum mechanics, that mysterious, confusing discipline which none of us really understands, but which we know how to use." What's interesting about that quote is, I think the conclusion, the last statement, is that we know how to use it. So what that speaks to is the fact that from an operational point of view, We know how to use quantum mechanics. We know how to make predictions in the lab. We know how to control systems and describe what will happen and what has happened to the system with certain caveats. On the other hand, he talks about none of us really understand. And what does he mean by that? Well, that's the interpretation of quantum mechanics. That's coming up with a story about what is. What is actually really going on? And one of the reasons why interpretations of quantum mechanics is somewhat at the edges of conventional physics is because it's concerned with that issue. Not the issue of how do we make predictions and control systems, but how do we come up with a story or an understanding of what's going on in the world, which in my view is part of the domain of physics, understanding nature rather than just being able to control and predict it. So let me start by going through the outline of the course so you know what's involved. And I have a handout here you can pass around. So I hope that's large enough to make out. Yes, I think.
And you go on the back. Read. So, is it okay?
It's okay. All right, good. There's a way to zoom in, but that device is off for now. All right, so, oh, sorry, thoughts for me. That's good, let me move this. Okay, so the course focuses on the interpretation of quantum theory. And one of the unique features of the course is that after the first few weeks in which I'll cover some of the basic introductory material, the remaining lectures will be given by invited lecturers who are leading experts in the field of quantum interpretations. Each speaker will be speaking about a topic on which they made significant contributions, if not seminal contributions, to the approach. And so you have the advantage of being able to challenge the people who are actually currently and actively defend these views about their positions and try and understand exactly what, if anything, each of these positions offers in terms of our understanding of quantum mechanics. So this week, we're going to cover the basic postulates of quantum theory. We're going to first discuss them in the kind of standard undergraduate textbook formulation, which is idealized quantum mechanics of maximal knowledge and no noise, perfect transformations, with the Schrodinger equation and so on. And then on Thursday, we'll cover a more generalized version of those axioms, those postulates, which includes the effects of open quantum systems and imperfect knowledge and unsharp measurements, which we'll describe in detail. And then some discussion, hopefully later this week, about the basics of what does it mean to interpret a theory, which will, as an exercise, go through interpreting two forms of classical theory, Hamiltonian mechanics, which is Newton's equations, basically, and Newtonian mechanics, which is an epistemic version of Hamiltonian mechanics. That is, by epistemic, which I'll define, it's a version of classical mechanics which applies when one does not have perfect knowledge of the system being described. In weeks 2 and 3, we'll focus on the original historical approaches to interpretation, namely the Copenhagen interpretation and the interpretation due to von Neumann and Dirac, which is by far the standard one, and discuss the infamous Mehrgen problem through Schrodinger's cat and the relevance of the projection postulate, which is also known as collapse of the wave function. And then in week 3, we'll discuss the EPR paradox, which first introduced the challenge of determining whether or not quantum mechanics was complete by a well-defined scenario on the basis of an assumption of non-locality. And from that, springboard into discussion of Bell's theorem, which is a demonstration of non-locality of any hidden variable model, all these terms will be defined very carefully, and we'll discuss contextuality as well. And then in lecture week 4, we have David Wallace coming to give us a lecture on the many worlds interpretation. David Wallace has a PhD in the many worlds interpretation, is now doing a PhD in the philosophy department on the same topic, and will certainly be an expert in that. Following, we have Shelley Goldstein giving a week's worth of lectures on the de Broglie interpretation, which is historically probably the most important interpretation, and that it anticipated many of the features of the quantum mechanics which were only later discovered, such as contextuality and non-locality. In week six, we'll get an overview of statistical interpretation from Leslie Valentine, who's my former PhD advisor. He's a professor at Simon Fraser University. And the statistical interpretation is basically a fully developed interpretation based on Einstein's views that quantum states represent all solves of systems. In week seven, we have spontaneous collapse models. Now, this is a special case because it's not necessarily an interpretation of quantum mechanics, it's actually a modification of quantum formalism to try and overcome some of the problems associated with the measurement problem. So, strictly speaking, it's not an interpretation, but a modification of quantum mechanics, which may or may not be experimentally correct, and is subject to experiments. In particular, after our after the spring break week, we had Anton Zeidler coming to discuss.
Statistical interpretation
is consistent with hidden variable theories. And what it attempts to do is basically come up with kind of a minimalist interpretation that does not commit to any particular statement about what's real. In some sense, it's an operational interpretation of quantum mechanics. But yet it's one that's consistent with hidden variable extensions. Which, by the way, was a very good question, because that's a question people would challenge Leslie Valentine as well as Einstein when he proposed it. In other words, statistics of what? What is it these are statistics of? So, as I mentioned, we have Anton Zeidler coming to discuss some recent experiments his group performed in Vienna to demonstrate interference, quantum mechanical interference of superpositions of very, very large macromolecules. And these are important both conceptually in that they demonstrate this effect, and practically because they are, first of all, a demonstration of the correctness of quantum mechanics on larger and larger action scales. And secondly, it can be formulated as a direct experimental test of the spontaneous collapse models. On the flip side of your page, the handout, there's a continuation.
Also, we should mention that Anton Dahlinger will give the public experimenters a lecture on the way to get the talk more kind of a general way about quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
And he claims that it's very
And then in week nine, we have consistent histories, which was a view developed by Bob Griffiths, is actually the person who came up with the idea. And later on, it was further developed by Marie Delmont and James Harnell in the term decoherent histories. Also, Roland Amnes made major contributions. But here we have the originator of the position. And then we have another kind of experimental interlude where we have L.A. Espé, who's a bit of a hero amongst physicists. He did the first experimental tests of Bell's inequalities back in the early 80s. And he will be giving us an overview of the tests of Bell's inequalities, both his and later tests, for higher precision. In week 11, we have one of the visiting scientists at Fermat Institute, Anthony Valentini, giving a more advanced discussion of advanced topics in the Bloy-Bohm theory. That's to be determined what he will cover exactly. And then in week 12, we have myself and Rob Speckens giving arguments for an epistemic interpretation of the quantum state, which is very similar to a statistical interpretation. And we'll discuss the grounds for essentially these arguments, as with Leslie Valentine's lectures, the argument about why the state should not be interpreted as real. And then we finish off with one lecture on last week by Lucian Hardy, who's a long-term researcher here at Fermat Institute. And he'll be discussing his work on trying to justify the axioms of quantum theory, which are at present mathematically abstract axioms, in terms of physical principles, in much in the same way that Einstein developed special relativity from the basis of physical principles rather than abstract axioms. So now let me turn to the evaluation for the course itself. 30% of the mark will be a class participation. So what that's about is one of the things that Ray and I both wanted was for this to be very much an informal discussion on interpretations. And we want students to participate in the discussion and challenge the lecturer when they don't understand something. Whether that's mathematical, of course, or whether it's some conceptual point. If you feel like you know, the lecturer is, you know, pulling the fast one on you, should say, I don't agree with that, I can't see that. And, you know, we let all the lecturers know this is the kind of classroom style we wanted to have, so you should feel free, interject whenever you want, and take part in the discussion, challenge the lecturer at all times, and that will be part of the basic screening evaluation. And there will also be assignments and a term project. The exact terms of the term project are not determined yet, but you'll be updated on that at some later time. And then we should also acknowledge the people and institutions that make this possible. Premier Institute has generously is covering the expenses of the lecturers to come for 1 week and give these lectures on the various topics. And of course, the University of Waterloo is sponsoring this as a course at the University of Waterloo. And it was Howard Burton and Rob Mann, respectively, who helped make that happen. So we are indebted to them for that. Okay, well, that covers the outline. So let me just flash the references that will be used in the first couple, in the first week. And while you're looking through that, I'll also pass out a sheet. I want to give you an opportunity to ask questions about the course. What's going to be expected of you, what the cover material will be covered, things like that. Anybody has any questions at present time? Well, it's up to Rob to get it published. We can make handouts available. Many of these references here are redundant in the sense that most of the material is covered in most of these texts in the first week. So any one of these will do. In fact, any advanced undergraduate text on quantum mechanics will do. These are the particular references I use to pull together the notes for this week. And what we may do is talk to Rob about getting handouts of insects. Rob Speckens and John Seifer putting together a textbook, which is a survey book on interpretations of quantum mechanics. And we're hoping to use it as a textbook, but unfortunately it's not finished yet. There are various chapters and various stages of completion. The book should be out within the next year or two, and it really will be kind of an overview of most of what's covered in this course. So before launching into the actual materials, let me just say that I'm going to try to give as general and detailed of an overview of the mathematics behind quantum mechanics this week as possible within the 3 hours. And I don't want you to be too alarmed. There's a lot of technical details that will come up, which I'll usually just state here rather than prove them. In fact, I think I don't prove any theorems at all. And and many of them involve kind of intricacies that you won't have to worry about. In fact, I would venture to guess that only about 20% of what you see will actually be used by the lecturers in each one. Okay. Some small fraction of what you'll see will be actually used by the lecturers and will be needed. You'll have to understand the material for their lectures. But I just want to give you as comprehensive an overview as possible, so when the lecturer brings something up, and at least you've seen it once, and then they can move forward with their discussion. And they won't be burdened with going through some of the elementary mathematics. So don't be overwhelmed by the mathematics that we'll go through today. But certainly do try to understand it as best as you can. I'd also like to get a sense of the background of the students here. So let me start by asking how many people are either registered or plan to be registered for the course. Undergraduates only. Undergraduates only. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. Okay. And how many graduate students plan to be registered? 2, possibly more. Okay. And then how many students would like to sit in an audit for lectures, essentially? Okay, about a dozen. All right, that's pretty good. So for the students taking the course, we need to keep track of your names so we can fulfill the class evaluation part of the mark.
So one suggestion I had was, next lecture, I'll bring a camera, take a picture, and then I will distribute it during one lecture, and then put your name, so we have a rough idea of which name that's in which place.
more question?
Yeah.
Do they have the quantum direction notes like is that only available online or?
Well, the lectures will be filmed by this camera, which has limited resolution, so it might be hard to make out all of the subscripts that I use. So you should take notes, certainly. But you will be able to catch any parts you missed through the online source. By the way, just let me talk to Kevin, who's operating the camera. I'm done with this system. Thank you. So here we have the course title, and what I'm going to do is start by going through the postulates of quantum mechanics in their standard form, and Thursday you'll see them in a generalized form. So we only need three postulates. First postulate is now I'm going to try and state these postulates in a language that's unbiased towards interpretation. We'll move that up and read it. So a physical configuration or a physical state is described by a state, what's called a state operator, which is a non-negative Hermitian operator. With unit traits. Rank one projectors are called pure states. They correspond to states of maximal knowledge.
What do you mean by Hermitian?
All these terms we need to find immediately.
Excellent.
So I'm just going to state the theorems and then define
them. You get 1 point.
All right, so what do we mean by this? So first of all, let me just make the note that many applications it's adequate to specify the quantum state using only the vector psi. which is an element of a Hilbert space. Okay, so before we talk about what Hermitian is and so on, let's first talk about Hilbert space. So what's a Hilbert space? A Hilbert space is a linear vector space with an inner product of phi dot. Here we're using Dirac notation. So the inner product is something that takes two vectors and maps them to a complex scalar. In mathematical notation, this would read what's an inner product. Please tell me the score here that I can
yes.
I don't know how our cameraman is going to capture all this. It's so dynamic. All right. Oh, sorry. Oh, what I should do, actually, can I get a volunteer to start cleaning that blackboard for me? Because, right, because you're going to get very, very covered in chalk.
I can get and then I can make somebody else.
1 point for participation. Alright, has everybody got this down?
Just a common one?
Yes.
Mathematical problem, sir. It's not just a vector space, but it has to have has to be completely disclosure.
That's exactly true. So this is true in a finite dimensional case. In the infinite dimensional case, there's additional constraint, which I'll also get to. So yeah, maybe one should add that caveat for now that this is true. Actually, I should probably add gentleman's comment immediately, which is that an additional property is demanded for infinite dimensional spaces, and I'll define what that property is in a few moments.
Just a stupid, curious question. Why people start using Hilbert space to describe the system? Like historically. Do we just, like, because people by that time find out that this mathematical model works for the quantum mechanics, so we just say, okay, we use Hilbert space to describe the quantum world? Or do they actually work that out, the theory of the quantum theory, quantum stuff, and then they derive this Hilbert space?
I think historically, and probably also correctly, the way we want to do it now is. In fact, postulate 3 will allow us to deduce the Schrodinger equation by considering the Galilean space-time symmetries, which is a group of symmetry transformations. And one identifies that, and then one demands by postulate it's a unitary representation, and then the Hilbert space is what's needed to support the action of those unitary operators. So there's an interconnectedness there that's kind of implicit in the structure. But
I would say historically, it came in by people thinking of position and momentum not as a scalar, but being represented by a matrix, which is an operator on this Hilbert space. And they developed that theory and said, yes, we can explain our nanometer
Yeah, I think that would be the Heisenberg approach as opposed to Schrodinger. Actually, the historical Heisenberg and Schrodinger came up with their own formulations, and then Dirac unified them with this focus space formulation. And actually, I'm not sure about the extent to which one can completely deduce the properties of the Hilbert space from consideration of the third postulate alone. So, and actually, we'll find out that Hilbert space is in some sense not really adequate anyway. We need something a bit more powerful, which I'll discuss.
Question: you finally see that's element of complex numbers?
Yeah. That means element of complex numbers.
And what's the one off of that?
That's also a C.
No. What's the difference between those two?
Well, this is just different notation. This is Dirac notation.
Like maybe we should ask this. How many knows what the Dirac notation means?
That's good.
So, is there anybody who doesn't know? Somebody asking the question the other way around without seeing pretty good. So everybody knows what the right notation is, so that's great.
That's useful when asking directions when traveling. Is this the way to so-and-so? Yes. Okay.
How about the second one? What kind of notation is the second one?
Well, this is, I think, the usual way mathematicians know the inner product.
Oh.
It's, two curly brackets with two arguments and a comma in between them.
Oh, okay.
And but Dirac uses this angular bracket with a vertical bar. So let's just clarify some properties of vector spaces. So we have some vector space which we'll denote with a V. The dimension of the vector space V is the maximum number of linearly independent vectors somebody asks what a Hermitian operator is, but everybody knows what Dirac notation is. That doesn't sound consistent.
Well, usually we'll say this is Hermitian, but we don't really talk about what that means. And you're just like, y'all better
Hermitian.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Okay. And then we're going to go with that.
Sometimes the definition, I think there's some differences between some people's definitions of Hermitian as well.
Well, there's a difference. Okay, a Hermitian operator is a self-adjoint operator, as I'll discuss today. But there's a difference that arises between infinite dimensional Hilbert space.
Yeah. Well,
question.
Specify the need a non-negative Hermitian operator, though.
Wait, why?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out the diagonal elements, eigenvalues, will be associated with probability. So we don't want them to be negative. In fact, the fact that we're demanding that it's non-negative implies that it must be Hermitian, because non-negative is only defined for real numbers, not complex numbers. And a Hermitian matrix guarantees that the eigenvalues are real. So it's a bit redundant to say Hermitian here, but it's clearer. Yes?
Can you say that Hermitian is just a name? Well, but I mean, it's a way of saying that it's physical.
Yeah, the postulate 2 will tell us that physical observables must also be represented by Hermitian operators, so we'll see that precisely. A lot of these questions are anticipating.
I would pick you on this, that the observables are indeed Hermitian operators. There are other operators that come in quantum mechanics which are not Hermitian, like the evolution.
Yeah,
like the ladder.
The ladder operators. So. This is a question about interpretation of quantum mechanics. So would you say that these are not real? Or you cannot observe them? So maybe, you know, if this is your question of reality, then they are not. So you'll be fine. But if I tell you, you have two operators here and there, and you know that they transform as a function of them into each other. The transformation, is this something real? Like you do the experiment, and it's real, it is real. So then I will pick you up on your question. Again, it's observable after the emission. But
someone's writing down some things we should have at our fingertips throughout the course. So the dimension is the maximum number of linearly independent vectors and a linearly independent set of vectors spanning the Hilbert space is called a basis. And so any vector can be expressed as a linear combination basis vectors. So, for example, let the set phi indexed by j be a basis. Basis of V. And psi an element of V. Then we can write size linear combination.
One question. When you say linear combination, do you mean finite linear combination or could it be infinite?
It can be either. Depends on whether or not the Hilbert space is finite or infinite dimensional.
Oh, okay.
The Hilbert space can also be continuous or discrete. We'll actually discuss each of these in turn.
Now, if you mean discrete, you could have infinitely many linear combinations, right?
Yes, you could have infinite discrete Hilbert space. So the sum here would run from 1 to infinity.
So it could be infinite.
Yes, this can be infinite, but this is a discrete set. Because we're representing it with a sum rather than an integral. So we're indexing the vectors by an index rather than by a continuous variable.
Because in the function analysis, of course, you have two kinds of basis. One is a Hamilton basis, another one is a Schroeder's basis. One of them is like finite dimension. One gives like the algebraic dimension, which is a finite linear combination. Another one gives you the limit, which is infinite linear combination. So, like, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, sure. I'm not familiar with those terms, but I like the fact that many of you will come from a more mathematical background and bring elements to the class that I'm not familiar with, and I'm happy when you bring in these comments. Yeah.
I believe the difference between a Hamilton basis and a Schroeder basis is that in a Hamilton basis, you demand that the sums have to be finite, whereas in a Schroeder basis, the sums are allowed to be infinite. And since here, the sums are allowed to be infinite.
It's a
Hilbert basis, which is something much stronger.
Yeah, I mean,
I assume you're talking about like orthonormal basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what the.
These bases haven't introduced orthonormality yet.
Right. But this is sort of a stronger version of the Schroeder basis. It's not like a Hamilton basis.
Yeah, that's what I saw too.
So I wonder what that sound was. That's the camera moving around.
Trying to find you.
All right, so I'm going to work on these boards now. I guess it's best to start with the top one. All right, so where are we?
The other one. So the other one. So when you bring, and then the one we got in front of you will be number two.
Work it out. Logistics on the fly here. So, yeah, so these aren't necessarily orthogonal bases yet, by the way. One can have overcomplete bases. So I'll introduce orthogonal bases in a moment. Let me just mention some examples. So, for example, column vectors, a linearly independent set of them, can be a Hilbert space basis, or basis for V. So we're all one would have components, C1, C2. And you can also have spaces of functions. So, for example, a space of differential, space of differentiable functions. Also, a form of linear vector space. In this case, a continuous one. Okay, now let me introduce the inner product. So inner product is defined by the following properties. One, when I'm using the asterisks to denote complex conjugation. Linearity. And there's the norm. The norm of the vector psi defined as the inner product of the vector with itself. Oops. And this has to be non-negative. Again, say in Dirac notation, you would write this as one would look like psi phi. I already mentioned that. Okay, let me move this up. Finish the notes there. So we can talk about now an orthonormal basis. Has the property where this is the product of delta function. So it's equal to 1 if I equals j and it's 0 otherwise. Okay, so let me just define the inner product. So for example, the inner product so for column vectors we have so phi is represented as a column A1, A2, and psi is represented as
column vector b1, b2, and then the inner product psi phi is equal to the sum over j bj star aj.
Yes?
Just a little ambiguity, I'm not quite sure, but when you're saying the inner product of like psi with phi, how do you know to order them? Because of course order matters. Like, where in the language does it tell you which one goes on which side?
Okay, well, I've skipped the whole discussion of the fact that Dirac calls this a Bra vector and this a Ket vector. So when you have, so the standard vector is the one I've just encircled. And that's an element of the vector space V. And then one defines Bra vectors, so Bra vectors are not actually elements of the vector space, elements of the dual space. Elements of a dual space, which is denoted B prime. And then I think just by consistency of the definition, with the norm having to be non-negative, one presumably by convention then takes a complex conjugate in the dual vector. Is that what you're asking?
I'm not quite sure when I'm supposed to take the inner product of the two, which order to flip them. Like if I flip them around, if I have two vectors, I wanted to take the inner product.
We can discuss either one, but normally from context of a problem, we'll specify which one is the dual vector and which one is the normal vector.
Okay.
So that'll be determined by the problem. Yeah.
For the, I can't pronounce it, but the Kronecker.
The Kronecker
function.
Yes.
Even permutations is one and odd permutations is zero?
Of the
subscript?
I'm not sure of permutations. It's if you have I equals j, then delta ij is equal to 1.
Okay.
If I is not equal to j. Yeah, it's not like a cyclic permutation.
Okay. Like not. And what's my other question would be, what is a dual space? What's the what do you mean you say dual space?
It's a space. Well, one answer that
it's
earlier.
A space of the linearly and bounded operators on functional of the Hilbert space.
Yeah, it's a space of functionals that assigns a scalar, complex scalar to a vector. That sounds nice to know. I don't know if we need to know all that machinery, but yeah. So the dual space is a space of functionals that assigns a complex scalar to a vector, and the elements. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the functions.
So that's like the operator space.
It's not really.
It's an operator.
Functional,
not
an operator.
From space to space, functional is from space to scalar.
Okay.
And in the dual space, it also has to be bounded.
Okay.
Like if you see,
yeah.
Yeah, it has to be bounded, so it's a complex number.
So yeah. That's the operator. The key point is the operators maps the vector space to a vector space, whereas the functional space maps vectors to scalars.
In the example there, the five psi, in the dual, the column vector is done a row vector.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, right. So the way to think of this in terms of the matrix representation is that psi would be equal, will be represented as. So then you have the multiplication of the row against the column and that representation. And then we'll also can look at, express these objects, try and cram this on here. When we have spaces of functions, so let psi of x and phi of x be complex functions. Then we can define the inner product psi phi as an integral over d mu x, where again the measure is going to be specified by the problem. Psi star of x.
One question about the dual space. Is the vector space V pretty constant? Like what? Is it dual space? Will the dual space go back to the original space?
I think so, but.
Like,
yeah,
dual space,
the dual space is the original space. Yeah.
Oh, okay. In common mechanics, it is.
Yeah. So. Yeah, there may be issues in infinite dimensional spaces, but in many of the problems of interpretational issues that will arise in the course can be expressed in a finite dimensional linear vector space. So all of these mathematical intricacies that come up in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces are not actually relevant because these problems can be stated in the context of a finite dimensional linear vector space where everything is very simple.
What is the new things?
Du of x is just a way of running the measure down. So if x consisted of like r, theta, and phi, and you're dealing with surface of a sphere, you would have sine theta, d phi, instead of just d theta, d phi. So that, you don't have to worry about that. In a physical problem, it would be clear what the measure is, but that's just a general way to write it. Okay. So now let me mention some issues that arise. If I'm just telling you this is important, let me actually give you some more details about infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So for an infinite dimensional vector space to be a Hilbert space, so infinite dimensional vector space V has to be complete in the norm. So people say complete in the norm topology. That just sounds more complicated. And what that means is that all vectors obtained from limits of Cauchy sequences must also belong to the vector space, must be elements of B. Okay, so Cauchy sequence some vector psi m defined such that so this is a sequence indexed by m, has to go to 0 as m from n goes to infinity. And if we define a vector psi equal to the limit as m goes to infinity, psi m, then this has to be an element of the vector space. And moreover, it has to have a finite norm. So the norm here. So that's a technicality that, again, won't come up, but it's just good to have it in your back pocket. This is a condition on the vector space.
Can you give an example why this is important in terms of why you need this condition? Is there a simple example that I can explain?
I think I have some of these notes actually. Actually, no, I don't have a good illustration offhand, but maybe I could look that up for next lecture. Okay. So, an important example, the Hilbert space. Is the L2 space. So this is the space of square integral functions.
complex value functions such that integral dx sine of x squared plus infinity. Which is a squared from a function.
Basically, what this allows you to do is normalize the state. These are basically these are state vectors which represent quantum states, and you want to be able to assign a probability, so it has to be normalizable. So let me mention one more nuanced issue, which is that in practice, we want to use wave functions. Of the form psi x equal to which is not a square integral function. Similarly, we want to use wave functions such as which is called a Dirac delta function, which can be defined as a limiting sequence of increasingly narrow normal functions, Gaussian functions. And now these don't belong in Hilbert space. They don't fit into Hilbert space because they're not square integral. And, in this case at least. And so what Dirac did to accommodate this, to accommodate the distribution function and these unbounded functions, non-square integral functions, is he introduced something he called the rigged Hilbert space. Now, people think rigged means it's rigged like a casino, just to get work done. But I understand that what he actually meant by rigged was the way you rig a sailing vessel when you're going to go off to sea. You get everything in order so it works properly, not to like trick people. So, so a rigged Hilbert space would include, I'm going to go to the textual definition of it, which involves defining a nuclear space and an extended space, and guaranteeing inner product satisfies certain conditions. The point is that with this rigged Hilbert space structure, one allows a notation involving kets, such as x naught, which in the position representation is equal to delta x minus x naught. And one allows non-square integral functions of the form. So the momentum representation, and the position representation of the momentum ket is what I wrote up there. So it's and so the point being that even though this function is not square integrable, we allow it and we make sure that all our observables are well defined at the end of the day, which involves just keeping track of things in a careful way. Yeah?
Could you go back to the IP sequences? It's a bit abstract for me. I'm not really sure what you mean. What is the sequence? Is what you have in the absolute values? Part of the sequence there?
No, the sequence is some set psi sub m. So I can write down some function psi sub 2, and then another function, another vector defined by psi sub 3.
So just any set of functions in our space.
Yeah, and some sequence that in some sense converges.
Towards something.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's a convergence sequence. Actually, maybe I should mention the word convergence in here.
Yeah, that would help.
It's the set of functions that converge towards, and the thing they converge towards is also the set.
Well, I guess the Cauchy sequence implies that it's a convergent sequence. So
yeah,
that's the key property. And so the fact that they converge, these are somehow well defined vectors.
They converge to that.
Yeah.
We just make up the Hilbert space based on just these vectors and throw all the other ones away. That's the idea.
No, you include all the basis vectors, all the normal vectors, and then you also add in all the vectors defined by Cauchy sequences.
Yeah, that's when you just take anyone who don't obey it, set them aside, and then you're left to help.
No, you add these in.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not
you. You find these ones, include them.
Yeah.
And the non
satisfied. Oh, yeah, yeah. The ones that don't satisfy these are distracted. Yeah, exactly. So you want to include these, and that's it. There's another pace back and forth, though. Glad the camera for it crazy. Okay, so lastly, I will now finally define Hermitian operators.
Would you mind pulling down
the force? Yeah, you can use the teleport.
Oh.
You need the right sequence.
Yeah. So non-negative. Non-negative row can be stated as the fact that mu row mu greater than equal to zero, all mu for the elements of the Hilbert space.
So row is just some operator?
Yeah, row is the state operator. Row is any operator. Any operator for which this is true is a non-negative operator. That's the definition. So, and then now, this implies the eigenvalues must be real, which is also guaranteed from the fact that rho is Hermitian. So a Hermitian operator shall define the Hermitian adjoint when I discuss the second postulate. So let me just state it now, it'll be defined momentarily. A Hermitian operator is one for which the operator is equal to its adjoint. And so now just two more miscellaneous comments. The first being that I said that the quantum state is pure, it's a rank one projector. There's equivalent ways of expressing that, which appear to be weaker, but are actually equivalent. And the first one is to say that rho squared is equal to rho, which is the definition of a projector. But because we apply a normalization condition, the trace rho is equal to 1. Because of this, this condition ends up being equivalent to demanding that it's a rank 1 projector. So what I mean here is equivalent definitions of purity for a state operator. So this is the first one. And the second one is that trace rho squared is equal to 1. So if we're dealing with a state operator, which is an operator that's non-negative and has trace equal to 1, then either these this condition, this equicondition, and the one I wrote in the postulate, i.e. that rho is equal to a rank 1 projector, which is a projector onto the Hilbert space, as a Hilbert space vector.
Okay. Do you see all rho for the...
I only have rows here. These are all rows. Yes,
there. Is there anything interesting about rank 1 projectors for those of us who have never heard of them before? Well, I recognize the rest of it. I just think it's fair I had it first, but maybe something extra comes with the
number. It's a projector onto a one-dimensional subspace of the Hilbert space.
Sure.
So it's...
Well, no, I mean, I'm familiar with the density matrix and all that.
We'll come across
the linear problem. If there's nothing special to a pure state density matrix, then we'll smile and nod.
Okay.
But if there was something special, I thought it would be a good time to ask.
Special about this terminology, you mean?
Yeah.
No, well, it's equivalent to these other statements, so you can take any one you want.
Okay. As your preferred density matrix.
Yes.
What would be a rank 2 projector?
We'll come across that in the next lecture, but a rank 2 projector would be a projector of the form a convex combination of rank 1 projectors.
Oh, okay.
So I want
to. Which you might blow as a matrix.
Okay.
Okay, we're taking the operating role on u, right? So it's the part of u with role. You're just taking the average value of role, right?
Sorry, where's the u?
At the very top.
Oh, here, yeah.
So you just gain the average value of role or whatever of, providing it's from each hit. Let's say it's, you're taking x. You're just taking the average value of x.
I don't use an average value. Basically, remember, an operator is something that, well, I'll define this in a moment. An operator is something that maps a vector to a vector. So an operator takes a vector u and generates another vector w. So now what we're saying is the inner product between u and w must bring u from 0. For this, so we have an operator for which that's not true, that the vector w generated by acting on any u doesn't give an inner product that's non-negative, then it can't be a state operator.
Yes. But just because when you're operating role on it first, right? So, okay, what's the notation for, and I'm just thinking this in terms of, like, if you want the average value of x, right? You take an inner product, like if you have a particle and a square well.
Oh, yeah.
Right, so you just want to find what the average value is. This can be in the center of the well, right?
Yeah, this would be like, for like a spin particle. This is equal to the trace of the projector of the u times rho, which is basically the expectation value, as you're used to seeing, of u in the state psi. Say, remember, rho is equal to psi. So this would be equal to psi u psi. So if you think of a spin half particle, you have two, the basis is spin up and spin down. So you have a vector for spin up, and this is the projector of the spin up vector. And you have another vector, we'll call it v, which would be spin down. And so if we have a state rho equal to psi, you would ask, what's the probability of finding spin up in the state psi? Well, we take the expectation value of the spin up projector. So remember, this isn't the average spin. So if one to know what's the average spin observed, and this will come in postulate 2, it would be the spin operator SZ, which is equal to 1 half, we'll call u the spin up vector, and minus 1 half, the spin down vector v.
Can you write bigger?
Yes, I probably should. I'm just trying to make this a quick discussion. But right, so the expectation value of the spin, which is equal to the average spin observed. If I observe the spin each time, you know from the Stern-Gerlach experiment, I either get spin half up or spin half down. But if I do the experiment 1,000 times, and I can find the spin is 0 because it's in an equal position of up and down. And then SZ is equal to 0. And we can think of this as psi SZ psi. And then, okay, I'm now using techniques I'm going to describe in the next postulate. So we can write the spectral decomposition of SZ this way, and then we get 1 half times psi u psi plus, sorry, minus 1 half minus 1 half psi v. So you can see how, right, well actually this is a huge digression, so let me just, I hope that after I discuss postulates 2 and 3 your answer will be clear. If it's not, then we'll have a general discussion after the postulates, and we'll take that up, okay? Because I need to introduce all these mathematical definitions. Yeah?
Can you just explain the first sentence on that top board again? The one you just covered. The importance of an Hilbert space is
an important case of an Hilbert space. An
yeah, I wonder example. What an important was.
An important case of Hilbert space.
Okay. And the L2 is that an L2? I think I hear about sometimes.
Yeah, there's the LP norms you hear about. So it's the right. So it is the L2 you hear about.
Okay.
It's the only L2 I know of.
Yeah. Awesome.
Well, for vectors. Yeah.
You said here the inner product of u and w has to now be non-negative.
Yeah.
So inner products are generally real now, not just complex, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a condition of having rho be a valid state operator.
Okay.
Okay, let me just define the trace now. It's the last thing I have to do. So we move right here. The trace of any operator A is equal to sum over 5j. Okay, 5j, where 5j is any basis, any orthogonal basis. In fact, it might not even have to be an orthogonal basis, but I'm not sure of that. Check ortho normal. Normalized orthogonal basis. Orthonormal just means normalized and orthogonal. So the inner product of the vector with itself is 1 rather than an arbitrary constant. So this is the definition of the trace. So you choose any basis you want, usually the most convenient one, which is the diagonal basis of A, and you take the sum of the eigenvalues. Yeah?
Okay, you have the equivalent definition to purity, and that's how you have the trace of rho hat equals 1, and then number 2
is... No, this is rho hat squared.
Yeah, but over on the far left, you have rho hat.
Oh, I'm saying if you have a state operator, which is normalized, So
that's normalized, and that is your
thing? Given a row, which is defined as the postulate 1, so the unit trace means non-negative, okay. Then the rank 1 projective statement there can be replaced with trace rho squared, or it can be replaced with rho squared equals rho. Those are equivalent ways to say the same, because there's two sentences here. The first sentence, which defines valid states, and the second sentence, which defines pure states. So I define pure states by the condition that rho equals the projector on its side. But I'm saying here that if we have a state that satisfies the first sentence, so an operator that's not any operator, just an operator that satisfies the first sentence, then we can define a pure state as from either this condition or this condition. It does, and could be equivalent to being a rank 1 projector.
Is that because of the if a trace of the operator is 0, then this operator is a zero operator. Is that a reason
you're that may be a special case. It's a more general reason, because in general, all this tells you, for example, if you just have any old operator, this just tells you that it's a projector.
Okay.
But you can have rank 2 projectors. So how come we know from this that it's a rank 1 projector? Well, it's because we've also imposed this condition.
Oh, okay.
So if it wasn't for this condition, we wouldn't be able to deduce the equivalence of this statement with the rank 1 projector. Oh.
But generally, is that true that the trace of the operator is 0, then the operator is 0 operator?
No.
No.
No, so the Pauli operators, for example.
And another thing is, I didn't catch up, was are those two conditions the same for the non-negative and the Hermitian? Are they the same? Equivalent? Or?
No, these are totally separate statements.
Oh,
non-negative
okay.
Row and this. I'm trying to use little bullets here.
Okay.
In separate points.
Does one imply another, or no?
No,
totally separate.
Totally separate. Yes, sorry. This implies this, but not vice versa. All right. So the class participation is excellent. Unfortunately, the amount of material covering is subpar, but that's okay. It's an important thing that you understand everything. We'll take as long as it takes. So, okay. I'm going to use up my last 10 minutes here to get to the second postulate. And now we've already discussed most of this stuff, so it should go pretty quickly.
Is there anybody who has a class at 4 o'clock at the university? So we should try to do it.
Are you registered for the class here?
Yeah, it's chemistry 4421. It's 4 o'clock.
And you're also taking this course for credit?
Yeah.
Wow. Alright, so.
Okay.
Wow.
Is this 2 hours?
Because it's 10 minutes, it's a 10 minute walk to get back there. So you really need your 10 minutes.
If you say, like, get there in 10 minutes, no problem.
Alright, so in the future classes, we're going to start promptly on time. If not,
is there anybody who can not make it for exactly 2:30?
Does anybody have a class ending at 2:20? That's good.
So maybe we could try to start it, which would be, would that make it very hard for anybody, and then we would stop at 10 to 4.
Yeah. Does anybody object to starting at 2:20? No? Basically, I'm squeezing extra 10 minutes out of you guys.
Okay,
so we'll do that. So, well, for today's lecture, is it okay if we go until 4 and then?
Uh-huh.
Okay, great. So each physical observable is represented by a Hermitian. So it's going to define all these Hermitian operator properties with this postulate. So now, here we'll let O hat be a Hermitian operator. Eigenvalues lambda L and eigenvectors lambda L. That means basically that O acting on the ket lambda L is equal to lambda L acting on the ket lambda L. Or this is an operator, this is a scalar. Then we have part A of postulate 2, which is that the set of possible observable outcomes is determined from the eigenvalues. Yeah, I'm switching from a lower case to an uppercase for L, and that has no significance. So the set of possible observable outcomes is determined from the set of eigenvalues. And B, now here's the physical significance. Well, this is the structural physical significance. The probability of outcome lambda L is given by the trace of the projector on the lambda L times the state rho. Sorry. The probability of outcome lambda L, I should insert here the caveat for, which I'll write down the bottom line. I don't know if this is blackboard, but we're going to use it. The probability of outcome lambda L is given by that expression
I'm not sure if you guys see.
Can you guys see this?
Yeah.
When the physical configuration when the physical configuration is described by rho. So rho is a state operator. So notice I'm not saying when the system is the state rho or is in the state rho, because those are, that's loaded terminology, which I'm going to avoid. I'm saying the system is described by this object. So there's a bunch of mathematical points I wanted to make. Let me just make the conceptual points about this postulate. And then we'll close on that and go through the mathematical details later. So, is there a question?
Yeah, you should raise my hand.
All right, well, hopefully it's up on the video. All right, so notice that postulate 2A, 2A is what gives us the structural aspect of quantum mechanics.
So this gives us
the structural novelties of quantum theory. Okay, I often use Q to mean quantum. So any Qs that aren't position variables mean the word quantum. So for example, we get when we have operators that have a discrete spectrum, that's the quantization. So operators with discrete spectrum, that's not all operators. There are many operators in quantum mechanics that don't have a discrete spectrum, but those that do are the ones that are quantized in the kind of, or discretized. Not quantized in the sense of quantum mechanical, but quantized in the sense of only a discrete set of allowed values is possible. So for example, atomic energy levels. Another example is angular momentum values. And a result of this is also the fact that electromagnetic radiation can only exchange discrete amounts of energy with systems A and B, with discrete systems, let's all say some systems, but in particular those that are represented by operators, energy operators that have a discrete spectrum. So this is what gives us photons. The particle-like behavior of light comes from the fact that electromagnetic radiation can be absorbed or emitted only in discrete amounts of energy. And that comes from the fact that the system it's interacting with has a discrete spectrum. Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand how you can approach a continuous spectrum state, but how can you ever get a continuous spectrum?
Well, an example is have momentum eigenfunctions for unbound for free particles. So the system is not subjected to any potential constraints. It can have any arbitrary value of momentum, just like in classical physics. So in classical physics, you can have any momentum for a free particle, and also in quantum physics.
It can still only exchange energy in discrete values, right?
Right, so then that means you're introducing a potential, and you're coupling that particle, whether it's a photon or a thin material particle, you're coupling it to some system, which is a potential, and that will give a characteristic energy spectrum. And then when it interacts with that system, it can only exchange energy in discrete amounts.
But how can you say that then? Since whenever you want to measure momentum, you're going to have to introduce something, right, to measure the momentum. Mm-hmm. So it just comes out of the math that we can
do. That's a really good point. How would you actually measure a continuous variable? I think all measurements are subject to discretization, and so really, the only reason I think we talk about a continuum would be because the mathematical formalism allows it.
Okay.
And that physically, we can never really verify it. But what we find quantum mechanically is that for some cases, not all cases, the mathematical framework itself does not allow a continuum. It just allows discretization. So it's not just an experimental practicality, but a structure of theory. But the theory doesn't demand that all systems have quantized spectra. Just those that are actually bounded, actually. That's usually the criteria. So the energy is less than the potential at infinity.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about like something like the mass of the particle? Does that fit in here? I mean, we don't find continuous values of mass in our protons.
It's the mystery. Where does the mass of the particle that we were on?
Or charge?
Yeah, those things are considered in quite discrete. Well, that's a super selection rule. Something like that. Isn't that enough familiar with the argument?
There is a reason for charge, but for mass, we don't.
That's fine, because they look exactly the same to me.
Well, they interact very differently. I mean, one has only mass is only positive charge, whereas charge comes in both positive.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then let me just mention quickly point 2b. So notice that so 2a gives us the characteristic structure of quantum mechanics, the structural mechanical aspects, namely we have discretization and so on. And postulate 2b gives us something totally different, which is really the mysterious part of quantum mechanics.
Lost my job.
And that is, it gives us the statistical character of quantum mechanics. So notice that here we have the set of possible observable outcomes. And here we have all of a sudden we're talking about probabilities. So not saying that the outcome is determined with that trace, but the probability of the outcome. So 2b gives us the statistical character, the statistical probabilistic So I'll throw a bunch of adjectives at you. Indeterminate. Character of, this is the quantum, not position, predictions. And this is, of course, a deeply surprising and, as Gell-Mann would put it, mysterious feature of quantum mechanics. That we can only predict probabilities and not definite outcomes. And much of the discussion of interpretation of quantum mechanics is trying to understand whether or not the probabilistic character of quantum mechanics is a result of the fact that there's a deeper underlying theory which is determinate about which we don't have knowledge. And so that is one of the central issues that will resonate throughout this course. So I think we'll conclude on that. On Thursday's lecture, I will go through more mathematical properties, and hopefully we'll have time to discuss the generalized formalism. So the next Tuesday, we can turn to discussions of the historical debate on the interpretation of quantum mechanics. So thank you for participation. And do we have any final questions as we end? Yeah, 2:20. 2:20 next Thursday.
I don't know.